Welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we look at the week's big political stories. I'm Mike Siluma. In this week's episode, we'll have an update on search for the country's new Chief Justice, with a formal departure this week of the incumbent Justice Mogoeng. It will also this week be looking at the developments behind the controversy in Phoenix, where the DA put up posters that referred to the violence that occurred there in July.
Man, this aircon is racist.
I've never, ever been a spy.
Can the DBS bank loot?
The problem is that pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whitening.
Order!
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a shit.
Can you please come
the
in?
Of order.
Let's welcome my guests now, Frenny Repkin, Sunday Times legal correspondent, as well as Lawson Naidu, Executive Secretary of the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution. Let's go to our first topic now. Shall I start with you, Lawson? When you are looking at the state of the apex court today, would you say that it is in a stronger or weaker position than it has been before?
Thank you, Mike. Look, I mean, I think, one would have to say that it is not the strongest that this court has ever been. I think it's difficult to generally compare courts from one era to the next. But certainly, given the number of vacancies that exist or likely to exist, the fact that, we have three judges at the moment who are on long leave, and there are a number of acting appointments, and there have been a number of acting appointments at the apex court for some time. So the constitutional court is not in an ideal state of health at this point in time, as we're about to fill a number of vacancies there. So I think it's a real opportunity for renewal and for the assertion of the authority of the apex court.
And Frenny, maybe before we go too far, let us take a step back and look at the process that is being followed to find a new chief justice. Is this a new kind of like territory, or would this have happened before?
It's not entirely new. There was a similar kind of process followed once before by President Nelson Mandela when Chief Justice Ismail Mahomed was appointed. But for the most part, since then, the president has nominated a single person who has then been interviewed by the Judicial Service Commission. What's important is that the Constitution itself kind of leaves the choice of the Chief Justice in the hands of the Prince, and the process that he follows is largely up to him or her when we have a woman president. So it's really quite a discretionary affair. And we've seen that there has been some criticism of the president, with people saying that this is not what the Constitution envisages. But certainly the way I read the Constitution, the President is not excluded from following this process, even though he's not specifically mandated to follow this process.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to just break it down very briefly as to what the sequence of what has happened and what is likely to happen next?
Sure, and I think it's important because there's been a lot of confusion about what has happened in the last week. What the President did was that he first called for public nominations. And that means that anyone from the public could send in a nomination saying, I think Lawson Naidu would be a great Chief Justice, and this is why. But there were some qualifying criteria, one of them being that whoever is nominated had to consent, and the other would be that they had to have letters of support. And obviously they have to be appropriately qualified under the Constitution. So we saw the nominations come in. What then happened was that the presidency published a list of all those public nominations that had come in that had fulfilled those specific criteria. So there was a nomination, the nominee had accepted nomination, and that they had gotten support of a legal organization or more. Obviously, there were, if you were disqualified, for example, if someone had nominated Sim Huing Huing to be Chief Justice again, he wouldn't have qualified because he's due to retire. Or if you didn't have a law degree, for example, maybe that someone like that would have been disqualified. And then apparently, according to the press release, there were people who were nominated a few times by different people. So, and then what we ended up with was eight names. And though those names have produced a lot of debate and some consternation, all that they are is the names of people who've been nominated by members of the public that fulfill those criteria. What is then going to happen is we now have a period for objections, where anyone can write in and say, we object to that candidate because of X, Y, and Z. That will close, I think, on the 15th. And then the important date is the date where the panel, the advisory panel that the president has set up to give him advice on that, will whittle those public nominations down to a list of between 3 and 5, the president said, and that's what the terms of reference say, and give that list, which is a real short list, to the president, from which he must then make his choice.
Lawson, given the timings, the fact that the incumbent is just about gone and has been gone for a while, why would the president go down the route of an extended public consultation like that?
Well, I think the president has indicated for some time now that he was going to follow a process such as this. I think the concern is that he launched the process too late. It should have been done at least a couple of months ago so that we would have had a Chief Justice identified by now. And when Chief Justice Mokoeng departs on Monday, the 11th of October, there would be someone ready to step into his shoes immediately. But, you know, we must all remember that, you know, this is a process that is similar to that the president has followed with regards to the appointment of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, as well as the Commissioner of the South African Revenue Service, where an open process like this has been devised and implemented. So it's in keeping with that, that kind of process that the president seems to prefer. And it's a process that I think that is welcome because it gives the public a sense of a stake in this process, being able to nominate people and to monitor the process to see how it unfolds, how the independent panel that Franny has referred to actually does its job, and particularly how it does its job after the 15th of October when they will have received all the public submissions on the candidates that have been nominated and ultimately develop a shortlist which they need to give to the president. And importantly, when they give that list to the president, they need to also provide reasons as to why they're nominating those 3 or 5 candidates that they will nominate to the president.
Mm. Then what kind of, you know, because I want to come to the outgoing incumbent shortly. But when we're looking for a Chief Justice, what sort of criteria, you know, some of them, you know, I suspect there'll be a long, but for you, the ones that stand out, you know.
There's a lot of things that the Chief Justice, a lot of qualities that one would hope that the Chief Justice would possess. And it relates to the roles that the Chief Justice fulfills. I think the most important are the ones that are specified in the Constitution. The Chief Justice must be qualified, must be fit and proper, and appropriately qualified in the case of the Chief Justice must mean sufficiently experienced. In the case of a Chief Justice, you need to have someone who can lead, someone who can lead in terms of intellectual leadership, someone who can lead in terms of, you must remember that the Chief Justice now is the head of the entire judiciary, not just the head of the Constitutional Court, which means that they must lead the whole judiciary. And that is a big, means being in charge of quite a big administration. That's a big part of the function of the Chief Justice now. Then, of course, as with all judicial appointments, charges us to think about the fact that the judiciary has to reflect our population in terms of race and gender, and that's a factor that needs to be considered when we look at judicial appointments. So that's something that we must be thrown into the pot as well. Those are the ones that I'm thinking of off the top of my head now.
Mm-hmm. And Lawson, I'd like for you to come in here. The outgoing Chief Justice, towards the end of his term, he seems to cause quite a bit of controversy. Would you say that he veered too much into controversial issues in society, or that there was part of the expectation with his role?
Well, you know, I think, you know, perhaps to add to what Franny has just said about the qualities one wants to see in a Chief Justice, and one of those qualities, Jesus, is the ability to be beyond reproach and ready to be, you know, the epitome of what we would want to see in a judicial leader, of a judge that, or a magistrate that any one of us might appear before, that someone who is fiercely independent, impartial, and so on. And I think in the latter years, Chief Justice Mokoeng has veered off that path. You know, he came in under cloud of some controversy when he was appointed in 2011. but acquitted himself very well for a number of years on the court, and you know, proved his detractors wrong in many, many respects. But I think in the last couple of years, he's sat in very few cases on the court. He's had a very hands-off approach, and he leaves the court under a major cloud, having been found to have breached the judicial code of ethics on his comments on Israel and Palestine. So he leaves under that cloud. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, there's a level of skepticism towards the court as a whole, because the leader embodies what the court is. And that's really what we want to see in a new Chief Justice, somebody that is going to be beyond reproach and is able to elevate the status and the respect that the Constitutional Court has and that the judiciary as a whole has, because it's through that person that we develop our perceptions of the judiciary as a whole.
Franny, just looking at the list that has come out, two names seem to have stood out in the last couple of days, that of the Western Cape Judge President John Shope and the public protector, Busisiwe Mkhwebane. What's the controversy about them? Why are they, you would think they're the front runner, the way people are talking about them.
I think the reason why they're standing out is because they're controversial. I mean, they are both facing impeachment. The public protector is on trial for perjury. Even if Judge Shope manages to set aside the impeachment process against him, because he's going to court on that, and even if the public protector doesn't get impeached and is found not guilty of perjury, all of that is not going to happen now. And the president has to appoint a chief justice now. It is inconceivable to me that the president could choose either one of those two now. You cannot choose a chief justice who is mired in misconduct allegations to the point where they are about to be impeached or be criminally charged. It's just inconceivable. And I think the fact that they are being talked about is because there's two reasons. One is that, you know, there was a bit of confusion as to what this list that was released was. There was some feeling that it was a short list from the presidency, and therefore what was going on, how could they be on the short list? So that was the first reason. And the second reason is that they have some support, political support from some South Africans. But I think realistically, support or not, it would be inconceivable for the president to appoint them.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Lozi Naidu, the Constitutional Court and probably parts of the rest of the judiciary have been coming under some political pressure, you know, with people publicly criticizing, you know, the judgments, etc. You know, sometimes even people are taking the judges, you know, to say some of the judges have been captured, they've been given money and that kind of thing. Would you say that that's a kind of expected and acceptable kind of development in a democracy or in a constitutional democracy? Or do you think that maybe we should be concerned about that?
Look, I think if there was any substance behind any of those allegations, then it would be acceptable. But it's got to be unacceptable when politicians in particular start attacking the judiciary and individual judges in the way that they have been, you know, without a semblance of any evidence to support the allegations, and the very strong allegations that are made against some of these judges. It therefore has to be unacceptable. It undermines the integrity of the judiciary. It undermines the respect for them, and it ultimately undermines respect for the rule of law. So I think it's something that should not be tolerated. And unfortunately, because of the leadership vacuum that we've had in the judiciary, we haven't had anyone to stand up on behalf of the judges and rebut these wild allegations that are being made. And therefore, they tend to stick because they're not being forcefully enough rebutted. And you know, that is sad, and that's why we're in the situation where these political attacks on the judiciary continue. And they continue because largely political cases that are being brought before the courts, through no fault of the courts. Courts don't choose which matters they hear. Political parties and politicians bring those cases to court and then want to use the courtroom as a political battleground.
Okay. Let us now thank our guests for this segment of our conversation. Lawson Naidu, Executive Secretary of the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution, as well as Frenny Repkin, who is the Sunday Times legal correspondent. We now go to the other big story of the week, for which we're joined by Thabo Mokoena, who's the Sunday Times parliamentary correspondent. And we are going to be talking about the controversy sparked by the DA putting up controversial campaign posters in Phoenix. This is what John Steenhuisen, the DA leader, had to say in Midrand while he was on a campaign trail.
No, I'm not going to apologize because I was on the ground. I saw exactly what was going on.
How were we, Mr. Steenhuisen? And this is exactly why, we saw what we saw, Mr. Steenhuisen, is a divided community along racial lines. And it was Francois Rogers, your KZN leader, who said the ANC is being opportunistic by using race. Why does the DA hate dealing with race when race
We're confronting the racism by calling out the stereotyping that was done by the ANC and its leadership in Phoenix. All they've done.
So there are no racial undertones with what happened in Phoenix. Let's be very specific here.
I'm saying to you that it is wrong. There were absolutely racial incidents in Phoenix. Absolutely. But you don't take a paintbrush and then paint the entire community of Phoenix as bloodthirsty, racist Indians as the ANC have done. There were heroic people in that community who stood up and protected the elderly. They protected young children. They protected businesses in the face of a government that completely lost control of the situation because they cannot even get the basics like policing right, just as they can't get the basics of water right here in Gauteng.
But Mr. Steenhuisen, as you say, there were, in fact, you know that there was no looting that happened in Phoenix. Most of the people that were killed in Phoenix were people who were passing by of African descent by nature. And there was also racial undertones, which are real. As the understanding, we were also on the ground. There were people that were killed for no reason. What do you say about those? And as a politician, you should know that perceptions mean a lot. What do you think the families of those that lost their loved ones are going to say when they see up those posters where you say people that killed their loved ones are heroes?
I didn't say the people who killed loved ones are heroes. Do not put words in my mouth. I said quite fundamentally that those people who upheld the rule of law and respected justice and protected their communities lawfully during the time are heroes. Anyone who broke the law is no hero of mine. I'm a firm believer in the rule of law, in constitutionalism, and standing up for the right thing to do.
Welcome to the show, Etam.
Thanks, Romek. Thanks for hosting me.
Is the DA taking down the posters or not?
Yeah, following intense public pressure, the DA chairperson in KZN, Dean McPherson, just issued a statement apologizing and announcing that he would be seeing to it today that those controversial posters are removed from the area of Phoenix. Obviously, this follows a very serious public backlash that took place all over media, on social media, on Twitter. We saw the DA leader, John Steenhuisen, having a torrid time yesterday. He was just at pains justifying these controversial posters that really, you know, smack of racism. I mean, we're talking about a situation where in July, more than 30 people, in fact 36 people to be precise, lost their lives in the area of Phoenix after some vigilante groups, you know, sought out to protect themselves because they were feeling betrayed or not protected by the police and the defense force at the height of the looting and the civil unrest in KZN. So, I mean, Phoenix is a predominantly Indian suburb in Durban. These vigilante groups, you know, they set up to protect themselves because, yeah, as I say, they felt betrayed by the police. But in so doing, they were sort of reckless because innocent passers-by, people who really had nothing to do with the looting, a lot of them black, were killed by these vigilante groups. I'm talking about innocent black people from areas such as Kwamashu and Inanda and other predominantly black townships. So it's quite a big deal. I mean, for the DA to put up posters that say the ANC called you racists, we are calling you heroes, whereas so many black lives were lost, you know, it exposes and reveals the lack of sensitivity the DA has on the issue of race in the country. It's turned out to be a spectacular own goal on the part of the DA. That has literally ended, colloquially, I can say, cheers for them, because, such a spectacular own goal at the height of an election campaign is so undesirable for any political party that takes itself seriously.
You know, Chabuchaba, immediately after the controversy started, the same Dean McPherson, you know, was on public media defending the decision to put up the posters. What do you think could have happened in the background to cause the climb down?
Outside the public backlash and how members of the media took on the DA on this issue, behind the scenes, a lot happened within the Democratic Alliance. There was a meeting yesterday of a provincial management committee of the DA in KZN, where this issue was raised quite sharply by what you can say, black leaders in KwaZulu-Natal. We understand that people like the former provincial leaders or Kele Mwango, Mbali Ntuli were quite at the center of raising alarm around this issue. They wanted to know how did these posters came about, because as a provincial management committee, they made it clear in that meeting that they had not sanctioned these posters. And they really demanded answers, which has led us to where we are now. We are seeing these things, these posters being removed. Also, we saw the DMRL candidate for Johannesburg, Paul Palazzi, also breaking ranks with John Steenhuisen in saying that, no, this is not something we should be doing as a party. We should be showing sensitivity to all racial groupings in the country. We can't be saying, you know, calling people heroes when black people lost so many lives. So that's what really happened behind the scenes. But like, there was quite sort of a big war within the DA behind the scenes until Dean McPherson eventually succumbed, issuing a statement this afternoon on Thursday saying that he's taking responsibility and even confessing that, you know, these posters were his own initiative and that they had not been sanctioned by anyone. Quite astounding.
For someone looking in from the outside, it actually defies logic that you're going into an election, you're a political party, you're going into an election. Presumably you want as many people as possible to vote for your party. But they, whoever, you know, whether it was Dean McPherson on his own or with others, they decided to, you know, in the way that it came across, that they were taking sides in, you know, on the side of the vigilantes in Phoenix, as against the rest of the black population in the area. You know, what does that say about the strategy, the electoral strategy of the DA in that area?
It shows you that there's really no strategy, Mike. The DA simply has no idea how to handle the issue of race, and it has backfired. I mean, their campaign now is in turmoil. They are in a situation where, I mean, wherever they are right now, they can't even send a message they would want to put out there to voters as to why they should vote for the DA. This thing has just messed up their campaign. Helen Zille today, she was in Komani in the Eastern Cape, where she had gone to inspect that controversial 15 million rand so-called stadium, and the whole thing just got dominated by the controversial posters. So they've really scored a very spectacular own goal. They've made campaigning for themselves very difficult. They may be withdrawing or pulling down the posters, but it certainly that's not going to make the issue go away. I think it will continue to haunt them going into this election. And by so doing, they've also sent out a message to potential black voters, even those disgruntled ANC supporters who were considering the DA as an option to the ANC or the EFF or any other party. They would certainly be reconsidering after this funeral. that exposes how the DA really shows little regard to black lives.
And just lastly, talking about other political parties, what has been their response? And has that been particularly helpful in terms of the tensions and the controversy, you know, that has been sparked by the posters?
Naturally, political parties opposed to the DA would seize the moment and mine the opportunity. They right now they're like, especially the ANC, they like, oh, of course we told you so. The DA is not a party to be trusted by you as black people. They have little regard for you. Just today we saw the Deputy Secretary General of the ANC driving a very similar message. She was very quick to rush to Phoenix to say to the people of Phoenix that as the ANC, we are here. Consider us an option. Forget about the DA. They care less about black lives or Indian lives for that matter, as long as they can secure the votes. So the response has really been just grab the opportunity and shoot down and use this crisis to shoot down the DA.
Okay. That's all we have time for on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly this week. And we'd like to thank our guest for this segment of the conversation, Thabo Mokgoni, who's the Sunday Times parliamentary correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us, Thabo.
It's my pleasure, Bobby.
And by the way, you can find a podcast of this conversation on iono.fm, on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer to source your podcasts. Until next time, we still say, stay safe, sanitize, wear the mask, and avoid crowded places. I'm Mike Siluma. Until next week.